from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, this is Forum. I'm Scott Schaefer, in for Michael Krasny. In just a few minutes, President Obama holds his first full press conference in 8 months. He's sure to discuss the resignation of CIA Director David Petraeus, fallout of last week's election, and the upcoming talks with congressional leaders aimed at averting the so-called fiscal cliff. As we lead into the press conference, we'll be talking about the president's mandate, if any, what the president might have learned from last year's failed negotiations with Republican leaders, and what might be accomplished in this lame duck session of Congress. We'll get started with Forum right after this. And welcome back to Forum. I'm Scott Schaefer, here today for Michael Krasny. And as we've been hearing in just a few minutes, President Obama will hold his first press conference in more than 8 months. We'll be going live to NPR for that. But before we do, a look at what the president is facing in this post-election period, how the election results might impact his dealing with a lame duck Congress as the nation faces the so-called fiscal cliff of higher taxes and automatic budget cuts. And joining me from the nation's capital, Mark Sandolo. He is Associate Academic Director for the University of California's Washington Center, and also author of Madam Speaker, Nancy Pelosi's Life, Times, and Rise to Power. Mark, good to have you with us.
Good morning, Scott.
Well, let me begin with Nancy Pelosi. She announced this morning that she was going to run for leader again. There was some suspense about that. Any surprises on your end?
Well, I was actually surprised. I thought that it was quite possible that she was going to make an announcement that it was time for her to move on, that maybe this would be her last term representing San Francisco, and that she would step down as Democratic leader. Not that it will affect book sales. For some reason, the title, Madam Democratic Leader, just isn't as catchy. But she made it very clear. I mean, I'm looking here at her quote. She said, being involved in politics at this level is insatiable. And interestingly, she came out to this news conference in Washington, and really going into the news conference, it had only been moments before that she told fellow Democrats her decision. And there really was a rare sense of suspense in Washington about what she'd say. But she brought out about 50 fellow Democratic women. And she said, look, you know, picture tells a thousand words. And these faces out here, and there were a lot of men who want to join us, but we told them no. These faces out here are worth millions of votes. And she made it very clear that she wanted, when the president sits down to discuss issues that we'll talk about in a minute, you know, with things like the fiscal cliff, that it wasn't just, you know, Mitch McConnell and Harry Reid, the men who typically sit at the table. She wanted a woman there, and she wasn't stepping down as a result.
And clearly there was a genuine enthusiasm among the women who were there with her. She has helped get many of them elected, and they no doubt think very highly of her. But what about within the caucus generally? Was there a sentiment that maybe it is time for her to move on, given that the Democrats only picked up a few seats this time?
Well, her chief rival, or the guy who really wanted to be the leader and ran against her a decade ago and has been her loyal lieutenant ever since, Steny Hoyer. He's a representative from Maryland who has about as liberal voting record as Pelosi, but appeals more to the moderate and conservative wing of the Democratic Party. He sent out a message within minutes of her announcement saying that he was going to run for whip, which is what he is now. So essentially he was running for the number two position, yielding to Pelosi. You're right, there was a lot of enthusiasm, but you know, you can picture, if you had a boss who you had mixed feelings about, and the boss stood in front of the company and said, I've decided that I'm not quitting, I'm staying right here to be your boss. Chances are you would say to him, hey, that's wonderful, or her. You would not say, really? We're just soon seeing you go. So the enthusiasm in public is not necessarily reflective of, but you know, Pelosi raised over $80 million for House Democrats for this election cycle alone. So she is popular, and, you know, there are people who have never known, there are people serving in the House who have never known a leader besides Nancy Pelosi. And, you know, the hope is that one more time she can take them to the majority and become Speaker again.
Well, and to have someone like that with that incredible ability to raise so much money, you can't just say, well, I'm not going to do it anymore. You do it. I mean, it's you have to build that up over time. I mean, it's not anyone can do that.
But at a certain point, you know, you sort of think back to, And yes, Pelosi is not there. In fact, she snapped at a reporter who asked about her age today. But you know, you think of guys like Strom Thurmond, who served in the Senate so long that when he was still serving, I remember one night reading that he had been sitting at dinner in a restaurant in Virginia and had simply said, "I feel tired," and fell flat face into his food. Now, he still continued to be reelected after that, and he was 100 years old before he died, and finally they carried him out of the Senate. You know, at a certain point, you got to give it up. Now, Pelosi is only 72 years old, and to her credit, she has more energy than anybody I know, including people, you know, a third of her age. So there's no reason to believe that she is about to tire out. That said, she's got, you know, 5 kids and 8 grandkids. She spent the last quarter of a century essentially working, you know, double time, triple time on behalf of politics and the Democratic Party. And at a certain point, you give it up and you hand it over. But that moment, which I thought might have come as early as now, and a lot of people did, it's not going to come now. She continues to lead the party at least for another 2 years.
And Mark, we do want to talk about the president. But before we do, if you look at the California congressional delegation on both sides of the aisle, there is a whole lot of seniority, a whole lot of years of service that are going to be going away come January, starting with Lynn Woolsey up in Marin, who was there for some 20 years. And, of course, Pete Stark, who lost, that'll remain a Democratic seat. But a lot of seniority, Wally Herger up in Redding, David Dreyer around L.A., and so on. So many, many years of experience. What impact do you think that will have, along with the fact that Republicans are going to maintain control in the House? What effect does that have on the clout that the California delegation is going to have in the next Congress?
The biggest factor for California in Congress is who controls Congress. I mean, that delegation, the biggest in the nation, was 53 members. At this point, we're still waiting for final results, but it's going to be a 2-to-1 ratio of Democrats. So it's going to be something like 37 Democrats and, you know, 16 Republicans, something in that order. And what that means is the most powerful Californians are going to be shut out of leadership. You know, it's certainly true for people like Pelosi. Being Democratic leader is not the same as being Speaker. But that said, you make a very good point. I mean, I think I added up as something like 250 years of seniority walked away. And this is a system in Capitol Hill that is based on seniority. And there are a lot of people who say what California did is a wonderful thing, because while other states are gerrymandering their districts and making sure that incumbents can't lose, California has much more competitive elections, and there are a lot of incumbents who are gone, and that's wonderful for democracy. The problem is, if California does that, but Texas and Florida and New York don't do that, you know, what it means is the guys from those states are going to become chairman, and you know, the women from California, Pelosi was quick to point out that the California delegation has, on the Democratic side, more women than men, they're going to be starting from the bottom, and it takes many, many years to build up that kind of seniority. And even if it's not even bringing, you know, pork home from the state, it's not as simple as that, but when you go into, you know, behind the doors negotiations on the farm bill, which is coming up, is there a senior Californian who can say, you know, look, we need an exemption for specialty nuts because that's what they grow in the Central Valley? There are thousands of items that need flexing of muscles, and California certainly has taken a step back in terms of seniority.
Well, let's move to the president now. He's going to be holding that press conference shortly. And of course, probably 3 days ago, or a few days ago anyway, a week ago for sure, he wasn't expecting to be talking about David Petraeus and General Allen, but do you expect that that will be at least a third, if not more, of this press conference?
There's so much to ask him. I mean, you pointed out that he hasn't had a full-fledged press conference in, was it 8 months, you said? I mean,
yeah, March.
That is shocking, especially for a man who is regarded as, you know, being such a great communicator. The fact is he's not good at these events. He gives great speeches. He's very, very bad at short, concise answers. But there's so much to ask him. Yeah, absolutely. On Petraeus, you know, why is it that federal investigators had been looking into this affair for months and months, but he claims that he didn't know about this until, and it worked out nicely timing-wise, the day after his reelection. You know, then there's, you know, the whole Benghazi incident, which is not related to Petraeus's affair. But how is it that a CIA station in Benghazi, which is apparently what was attacked on September 11th, wasn't better protected? And why is it the president spent a whole week talking about, inflammatory video having set it off when it turns out that wasn't the case? But you go down the list, I mean, between Petraeus and Benghazi, the tax cuts that he insists have to happen for the middle class but not for rich Americans, sequestration, Medicare, Medicaid, the election results itself, legal marijuana. Two states voted to legalize recreational marijuana. That means state law in those places, Colorado and Washington, make it legal to possess marijuana, but federal law makes it illegal. What's he going to tell his State Department? Are they going to go into those states and violate those states' autonomy? This press conference, if it were up to the media, could go on for hours and hours. Yeah. I'm sure Obama will cut it off before that.
Well, and the Department of Justice, just on the marijuana question, the DOJ has been very adamant here in California that they've been going after some of these clubs and others involved in the medical marijuana system here in California. So very unpopular with many, including, I think, the Attorney General Kamala Harris. But we'll see, as you said, what he might say about Colorado and Washington State. And of course, you know, we've been chatting, Mark, for a few minutes. We haven't even mentioned the fiscal cliff and the tax cuts that are set to expire and all of these, the sequestration, massive cuts to spending that are also going to happen. What's your take on the president's hand that he holds after this election?
I think remember there was that clip of him talking to Medvedev, the Russian leader, saying, hey, after this election, I'll have more flexibility, so talk to me then. And, sort of a weird, a strange thing for him to be saying. But the case is true, I think, in domestic affairs, too. Politically, he doesn't have to worry anymore. I mean, they always say, oh, the best politics is good policy. And, and that's to a certain degree true, but sometimes politics gets in the way of policy. At this point, Obama really doesn't have to worry about what people think of him, and he is able, as a result, to stand up there and say, you want to go off the cliff? Fine, let's go off the cliff. There are a lot of Democrats now, and it may well be a negotiating stance, who say if this cliff happens, and what we mean by the cliff is that tax rates go up for all Americans and big, big spending cuts, which are forced by law if Congress doesn't compromise, take place, which economists will say, could send us into a recession, that if that were to happen, it wouldn't be the worst thing in the world for a month or two because it would force Republicans to the negotiating table. Now, it could be that's the kind of thing you say right before you, turn the wheel away in a game of chicken. But the negotiations begin essentially tomorrow in Washington. I think the president's going to sit down with congressional leaders, with Pelosi at the table, and they're going to start to hash this out. And there is pressure for both leaders, including Obama, to have some grand, big compromise. For Obama to say, I am willing to reform Medicare if the Republicans are willing to raise taxes. But, the grassroots don't like that. That's not going to be a very popular position in San Francisco, where changing Medicare is not a solid position. It's not going to be popular in John Boehner's district and among his constituents in the House, among the House Republicans.
Yeah.
Many of them said, no new taxes under any circumstances.
Well, I think that meeting with the congressional leaders is Friday, but there is a meeting later today with CEOs, some of whom are beginning to pressure Congress and presumably the White House as well to cut a deal to avoid the fiscal cliff. What role do you think the president and the Democrats would like the business community and Wall Street to play in these upcoming negotiations?
I'd love to have heard the president. He spoke to labor leaders and what they said were progressive leaders yesterday on this exact matter, and then the Chamber of Commerce and some business leaders today. Would have loved to have heard the comments side by side to hear if he's telling both sides the same thing. 3 weeks ago, he would have had to tell business leaders, be patient, stay with me, don't give all your money to the Republican Party. He doesn't have to say that anymore. I mean, of course he wants their cooperation in terms of hiring, but I don't think any business leader comes out of the White House saying, I'm going to go ahead and invest $1 million in new workers, even though I think it's a stupid economic move, because the president asked me to. And I think what the president probably told them is, this is what I'm doing. I mean, now he can afford to stand up to both sides. And the progressives, the same thing. They can't say to him, Mr. President, if you do that, you may lose votes on Election Day. We won't turn out for you. That's over. And that's why he has more flexibility. So I would expect you people see as stubborn and resolute in Obama, you know, in this press conference than we've seen before, because he no longer has to play politics.
And Mark, we're going to go to NPR in just about 40 seconds. But if you could ask a question, if you were at the press conference this morning or this afternoon, Washington time, what would you ask? 10 seconds.
Who do you think is a better team, the Ohio State Buckeyes or the Florida Gators?
I'd love you to always revert to the sports
calculation
questions.
Calculation go through his head when he starts adding up which damn answer. Which I don't know, Scott, but I won't get that chance. But we'll let the White House press corps do just that.
All right, Mark Sandelow, associate academic director of the UC Washington Center. Mark, always good to talk with you. Thanks very much.
Thanks, Scott.
And we are going to go now to Washington, where President Obama will be holding his first press conference in some 8 months. I'm Scott Schaefer, here today for Michael Krasny.